I'm up on a tight wire.
Welcome to Words on a Wire. I'm Tim Hernandez, and today we're going to have novelist Benjamin Whitmer, who is the author of the newly released novel Cry Father, published by Simon & Schuster. The book is a haunting story about men, their fathers and sons, and a legacy of violence. And it's been written in the tradition of, I guess one would say, Cormac McCarthy and Larry Brown. We're also going to talk to Ben about his last novel, Pike, which was recently optioned for a movie, and then his connection with the Louvin Brothers, the country music legend duo. And then, of course, on Poetic License, today we're going to have Carolyn Ayoub, who's going to speak to us a little bit about her wonderful work with turtles in the Peace Corps. Stick around. Ben Whitmer is the author of the newly released novel Cry Father, published by Gallery Books, an imprint of Simon & Schuster. Ben's work has received rave reviews from places like the Kirkus Review, the New York Times, NPR, and the Los Angeles Times, among others. His previous novel, Pike, was published by PM Press in 2010, and it was recently optioned for a movie in France. And his nonfiction book, Satan is Real, The Ballad of the Louvin Brothers, was co-written with country music legend Charlie Louvin, and it was chosen as a New York Times Critics' Choice Books. NPR's Book Nook says of the author, Whitmer is one dazzling storyteller. Ben Whitmer, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Hey, man, thanks for having me.
You know, the first time I became familiar with you and your work, I don't know if you remember this, but I think it was when your book Pike was just released. And I know you were doing a reading at CU Boulder there, I think was with Stephen Graham Jones, was one of the authors, and a few other authors there.
Yes, it was from Pike.
Right.
That was a great reading, too, man. Anytime you can get a chance to hear Stephen Graham Jones, it's always good.
Yeah, and Stephen's work I'd heard before, but I had never heard of you or your work before. And then in that moment, I remember after you read, it was humorous, and it was all the good, dark stuff that I love, you know, as an author myself. And so I said, this guy sounds like my kind of author. And so I started to read your work right after that. But it was great, man. You know, I think I had even messaged you at one point because I saw your book, Cry Father, the new book, which is a fantastic book. I was actually standing here in El Paso at the airport, and I saw your book perched up on one of the bookstore shelves, and which has always been a dream of mine to have a book in an airport.
Mine too.
Yeah, and I saw that, and I said, man, I think that's Ben's book. And I walked up closer, and I said, yep, sure enough, what a great cover. It's stark, you know, it just jumps right at you. And the title, Cry Father. You know, how'd you feel about the final product, you know, the way your book came out, the way it looked and all that?
I thought they did a beautiful job, man. I was real proud of it when I saw it.
Right.
They actually had an alternate cover that I think they're going to use for the paperback, but I think they pulled it. It had lots of color, and it was very, you know, pretty looking, and then they pulled it and went with this one, and I just went nuts for this one.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if I would call it this one pretty, but it's definitely eye-catching.
Exactly.
And that's what you want, man. It's kind of like, it's just real representative of your stories themselves. And I was curious, too, about the title Cry Father. Are you the type of author that, you know, has a title first and then you kind of the story follows that? Or was that something that just came naturally out of the story itself?
Neither one, man. I'm terrible at titles. So, you know, I go on searching expeditions, you know. I spend 6 months reading incredibly dumb stuff just trying to find a good one.
Right.
In this case, it was a George MacDonald sermon from the 19th century that gave it to me.
Oh, wow.
And then, yeah, I don't know why I like him, but I'm not actually a real religious guy. But so I was sitting around reading a sermon for some reason.
Wow, that's
and,
great.
And it just struck me.
Now, as for your book itself, you know, I'd been doing a lot of reading up on it. The book is fantastic. And I see also that the book is often compared, not just this book, but even your previous book, Pike, is often compared to Cormac McCarthy and Larry Brown. You know, those are two authors whose stories have this very distinctly American West, quote-unquote, sort of American West sensibility to them. And certainly, you know, their tendencies to write towards these flawed characters and obviously even the more violent aspects, right? Your characters and your books are really sort of inhabit a distinct world also. And I'm wondering, well, why don't you tell us a little bit about your book, how the idea came to you?
To be honest, I really don't know. Actually, it started as a framing device for a historical novel, which ended up being dead in the water. It just never worked out. But I liked these characters so much, you know, that I just couldn't get past them. Mm-hmm. So I just decided to finish it myself.
Right.
I just had kids born. You know what I mean?
Right.
And all I was thinking about was how bad I'm going to screw this up.
How's it going so far?
I mean, luckily I was blessed with great kids. You know?
Yeah.
They don't take a whole lot of work. They're just wonderful by themselves.
Yeah, so I know. I think my kids are the same, right? In spite of their father, you know, they turn out to be good kids, you know?
Exactly. No matter what I do, I can't seem to screw up their lives, so it makes it nice.
That's good. That's good. You know, why don't you just kind of give us a little bit of just sort of the background or the summary, basically, of the book, the story itself, you know, around this wonderful character, Patterson Wells, and the relationship he's got with his father. Would you mind giving us just a little bit of background on that?
No worries. So my character, Patterson Wells, is actually based on one of my best friends is a tree trimmer in Ohio. His name's Lucas Bogan. And he'll come through Colorado now and then. It's been a few years now. And we'll just kind of disappear for a little while. One time he came through and we disappeared. And we were up driving around the mountains listening to, I think, Towns Van Zandt.
Nice.
And, you know, drinking beer.
Right.
looking around. And he was telling me about his job, you know.
Right.
And I couldn't believe it. So my character, Patterson Wells, you know, he's a tree trimmer.
Right.
Works disaster zones. You know, so there's a hurricane or something. He goes down and tries to clear them out.
Right.
His son has died a few years back, and on the summers he just kind of comes back to this place in the San Luis Valley, which is a mm-hmm. place I love. So I just basically wanted an excuse to go camping there for, you know, for a few years.
Yeah, I hear that.
So he comes back to San Luis Valley and just kind of sits in his cabin and stews, you know, thinking about his dead son and doing things he probably shouldn't.
Right.
And so he meets this other character named Junior, who's a meth runner. Mm-hmm. Up from El Paso, actually. El Paso's always been like one of my, I don't know why, but it's always been like a magical place in my imagination, too.
Yeah.
I think because of Tom Russell and Cormac McCarthy and, you know, even Phil Oaks.
Right, yeah, Phil Oaks, that's right.
Right. So it gave me an excuse to drive down to El Paso. So
nice.
That was great. And I got to go to Dave's Pawn Shop and walk around, you know.
That's great. Did you find anything interesting there?
I have a scene where he walks into Dave's Pawn Shop. Man, I listed out like 50 or 100 things. And I was like, I can't do that. Nobody cares with me.
The other thing I get, too, in both of your novels, but particularly in this one, Cry Father, is that real attention to landscape, as you mentioned yourself, the San Luis Valley there in Colorado, which is a place I love, by the way, the San Luis Valley. Gosh, I could buy land out there and just retire there forever, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. And, you know, you really a lot of the book is set there, and I loved it because I spent a lot of time, you know, I used to work for the Colorado Center for the Book there. And part of my job was to drive to all these rural areas, to all the four corners of Colorado. And I got to really understand the land out there. And one of my favorite places to always go through was the San Luis Valley. And so I love the setting for that. You know, what is it about, what made you want to set it there? Other than, you know, being able to get out there, would you say being able to take some camping trips out there?
Exactly. That's what I mean. It's just, I was driving through, I was driving down to Taos to meet my mother with the kids one weekend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she goes down there now and then, and then she gets a little house or something, rents one.
Right.
And we come down and visit. And I was driving down there, and I hadn't done the San Luis Valley before, but I went up through the La Vega Pass, is that right?
Yep, right.
Outside of Walsenburg?
Right, yeah.
And you drive up through that, and it's just, I mean, it was probably the most intense 5 minutes of my life or so, you know, just coming over the top and seeing this landscape kind of break ahead of you. And just, there was no part of it I didn't love, you know, desolate in a way,
yeah.
But also sparse in a way, but at the same time, just it was just so beautiful.
We're talking with the author, novelist Ben Whitmer, whose new book, Cry Father, is published by Gallery Books. You know, one of the things when I'm here teaching to my students here at UTEP, one of the things I talk to the students quite often about is how, you know, the whole book from cover to cover is all part of the story experience, you know.
Yes.
As soon as someone reaches, pulls that book off the shelf, sees the title on the spine of that book, and they pull that book, that story has already begun, you know, it has to already leap out. And and including even sort of that internal sort of not necessarily the story part itself, but even like things like dedications and front matter are all part of that experience, you know. And I was reading, too, that you had this – and correct me if I'm wrong. You're saying something about how you really pay probably more attention than you should to dedications.
True enough.
You know, tell me a little bit about the dedication for this book. And here's why I was fascinated by it is because the dedication – I mean, it really relates directly to the title of the book, Cry Father.
I think, I mean, it does, and actually, it had an initial dedication. which I believe was for my parents with all my apologies and for my children with the same. But in the process of writing it, or you know, working on it, probably my best friend since high school, his name was Paul Shank, he was killed by the police in a shootout with a SWAT team in Yellow Springs, Ohio. And, you know, he was holed up in his house alone, kind of just trying to keep him back. He was drunk. He was scared. He had a bunch of problems with mental health. And his daughter, who was 13, was actually out front, you know, begging the cops to let him talk to her, or let her talk to him. And, you know, anybody who knows Paul knows that if he heard her voice, then he would have walked out in a minute.
Sure.
But he never got the chance because they just they had a sniper there.
Right.
And they just shot him in the head.
Hmm.
So I dedicated it to his kids.
Do you have the dedication there in front of you?
Yeah, I do.
It says
for Max Moody and Grace Rosalie, that's his son and daughter, who had one of the best fathers I ever knew.
Right.
When I first had my kids, he had his before me.
Hmm.
You know, again, like I said, I'd always be terrified. So we you know, sit up nights texting each other or whatever, and I just go, man, I'm screwing it up. What am I doing wrong here? He'd say, settle down, man. Make him some fruit salad or something. His way of taking care of people was always to cook for him, you know?
Right, yes.
He governed his house. He never had any money at all.
Right.
Lived in a garage, but at the same time, you go over to his house, and he'd always find something to make it eat. And if there were kids around, he'd invent some game, you know, out of sticks or whatever.
Right, right, wow.
Just an amazing guy who loved kids and loved people.
I'm going to actually shift gears a little bit here. You know, I think ultimately what we're talking about here are just the folks that sort of, you know, influence or maybe inform some of your work. It sounds like, you know, your friend Paul and some of the experiences of you being out in sort of the San Luis Valley area. And in the same way, I want to talk a little bit about how music influences your work.
Yeah, music, I pretty much live by music.
Yeah.
I have kind of particular tastes. So, you know, when I'm writing, which is pretty much always, I can't listen to music that doesn't, you know, doesn't welcome me into that world.
Right.
So I listen to a lot of, country music that, I don't know, they call it, Americana now? I just call it country music. That's what Charlie Lubin used to say when I wrote that book with him. He'd say, you know, it's just country, man.
Well, you know, let's talk about that book. It's called Satan is Real, The Ballad of the Lubin Brothers, which is, I guess they called it a kind of a Cain and Abel story of one of the most legendary country duos of all time. I know it got great reviews in the New York Times, New Yorker, all those papers, LA Times. And you know what I loved about this is I read this quote that Emmy Lou Harris, she said, there's something scary and washed in blood about the sound of the Lubin Brothers. And I swear I thought that was a blurb for your book, for your kind of storytelling, you know, something scary and washed in blood. How did that come about, that project, you working with Charlie Lubin directly on this book?
Man, to be honest, like so many things, I have no real idea. My agent called me up one day and said, you know, I know this guy looking for somebody to write a book about a bluegrass singer. Do you have any interest? And I said, sure, you know, check it out. So then he said they want an excerpt from one of your books. So I sent him an excerpt from Pike.
Right.
He contacted me. It was actually Neil Strauss, who's he does the game and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting character. He emailed me and he said, I love the excerpt from Pike. You captured the 1950s South so well. I went, huh? It wasn't said in the South. And it wasn't said in 1950s.
Right,
so
right.
I said, okay. So I found out it was Charlie Lubin, man. I was on it because I knew his story and
right.
The chance to sit down with somebody and hear firsthand stories about Johnny Cash, that was enough to sell me.
Yeah, and you know, what was that first initial sort of interview or conversation you had with Charlie Lubin? What was that like for you?
It was pretty intense. I mean, we just kind of talked on the phone the first time. I went down to Nashville. I actually stayed with him for a week or stayed at a hotel near his house and hung out all day and talked, but the first one was just kind of intense. I didn't know what to expect. But the minute I heard him, I could hear the book. You know what I mean?
Wow.
Because his voice was so strong. And, you know, his character came through so hard, I just realized, you know, it's got to be first person. It's got to be his voice. And it's going to be great.
Were you, like, recording that conversation? Were you just writing notes down? Or what was the method for that? Like, what was your approach to that?
So I'm a moron. And I've never done this before, so I had no idea. So I recorded him, and I got like 50 hours of recordings or something. And, you know, a lot of times he was he had pancreatic cancer at the time, and his mind was sort of coming and going here and there. So he'd tell the same story, you know, three or four times, and it'll be different.
Right, right.
So I kind of meshed them together and stuff.
Right.
But, yeah, then later on I was talking to somebody who had done one of these, and he said, yeah, you know, you need at least 10 to 15 hours of recording to get a good book. And I just went, oh, my God.
Yeah, I hear you. I was involved in a project also like that, where you have to interview someone who's had quite a life, and then you can ask them the same question over and over, and you end up getting maybe not different versions of the answer, but certainly more detailed or even embellished versions of the answer. You know,
exactly.
It's great. It's great stuff for storytelling. You know, it just is.
And a good inquiry into the process of memory.
Absolutely, it is. You know, in fact, my book, Mañana Means Heaven, which was based on interviews also, that was one of the things that I had no idea the book would be about at the end, which was memory. And that's what it became about because of our conversations. I was like, found myself analyzing what that meant, you know?
Exactly. It's a process. You know, you don't quite know what you're doing until you do it.
Right, right, exactly. So you were a fan of their music before that project then, clearly?
Yeah, I mean, I thought sort of about them. It's kind of embarrassing. Because of the, when I was in my 20s, you know, Nick Cave put out that album, Murder Ballads. So I was going out trying to find every example of murder ballads in American music I could find. And, of course, they kind of invented the genre, you know.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Some tragic songs of life and all that. I just fell in love.
Nice. We're talking with Ben Whitmer, author of the book Cry Father, the new novel out by Gallery Books. So, Ben, I saw here that you have your book, Pike, was recently optioned for a movie out in France. You know, you got that cooking now, and I'm wondering, you know, you got a memoir or a biography that you wrote, fiction, you got books, movies now, all that. What's next for you? What's coming up?
I got a good one in mind. It's a prison break novel.
Nice.
So, 48 hours, you know, just bam, bam, bam. I can't wait.
We're looking forward to that, Ben. Thank you so much for joining us here on Words on the Wire.
Thank you so much, sir.
My name is Carolyn Musem Ayoub. From 1994 to 1996, I had the good fortune to serve as a teacher trainer in the Peace Corps. Panama became my adopted country, and this creative nonfiction piece is about a wildlife project in which I participated. The story is entitled The Call of the Isla. When the call to rise comes just before midnight, our crew of Peace Corps volunteers shimmy out of sleeping bags and grab shoes placed within easy reach. Catherine, my fellow volunteer from Chitre, Panama, as well as other young environmentalists, are eager and confident in their mission to save the turtles in La Isla de Cañas. Our energy, palpable in the dark rural schoolhouse, spills out into the muffled air of the forest. We hurry as shadows, single file along a dirt pathway. I can barely make out Catherine's yellow backpack as she weaves two paces in front of me. The moon, peeking out from time to time from the thick cloud cover, traces our route through thick undergrowth to the mangroves. Ahead, someone trips over a root, uttering something unintelligible, but our feet refuse to slow down. We repeat the call. Tortugas, sea turtles. We hear the surf, a whooshing of air and salt water before we see it. A damp chill runs down our spines. Then we step into the open landscape where an eerie glow ripples across water. Swirling foam slides over the inky waves, wetting the sands. Hypnotized, we watch the water roll back and forth. What is that shape over there? Our heads turn to look further from the waterline. Could that black spot, that hump, be a turtle? Catherine catches my eye and asks in her silly way, "Did we get the wrong address?" I laugh along with her, but I feel a dip in my stomach. I am the only Peace Corps volunteer who isn't a scientist. What do I know about saving wildlife? Be positive, I tell myself. you're here to help. I move forward to listen when our leader calls us together for instructions. Keep an eye out for turtle tracks and give mother turtles the right of way. Don't shine your flashlights on the turtles while they select their nest. We shift our feet in the sands, looking beyond the shoulders of our guide. We see nothing yet. He goes on saying, "Your job is to bury any uncovered eggs. You'll see why this is important when more turtles come in." His words hang heavy in the air, and for a long moment, my body merges with the dark skies and water. I feel the waves roar in and pull back, the ocean's heartbeat, my heartbeat. I sense the glowing moon moving silently through the clouds. The speaker breaks my trance. "As you know, Panamanian egg collectors are still allowed to harvest up to 200 eggs until the one-week moratorium starts tonight after midnight. Until then, you'll be seeing some of the Islas Pescadoras with cloth bags collecting turtle eggs." Catherine and I exchange glances. I know she tried a turtle egg once. Shrugging her shoulders, she had told me, "It tastes like an egg." I hadn't the appetite. Our group spreads out on the beach after the charla, breaking into pairs of workers. Catherine and I walk, looking down at our feet for any tracks, a sort of tipsy-turvy slide purporting to be around 2 feet wide. We circle away, then head back toward one another, speaking occasionally as we cross paths. In the distance, we see the fishermen with their flashlights roaming across the waterfront. Suddenly, a flashlight seems to lower itself on the beach, and a shadowy figure bends. The light goes out, and the air seems muted. We draw in our breaths, knowing something is happening. Then, as he moves away from that spot, the faint light returns. Another flashlight goes off, and Catherine and I pick up our pace. We crisscross over the beach, looking for a turtle nest with exposed eggs. We can't wait to cover any unburied eggs. As I pass Catherine again, I look at her face for any sign of success, but she just shakes her head. Our flashlights move peacefully over the dark scape for some turtle signs, a dark mound, an elongated shoveling from the tide lines. Then it happens. A few meters behind us, the surf sounds different. Alerted, Catherine turns looking to the left. I step back toward the weaving lines of water. From the corner of my eye, a mother tortuga rides the wave to shore, her front paddles hitting the sands. She spurts forward about 3 meters with heroic gulps of energy. I want to holler out to my compañeros, but I don't. I know not to distract her. Momentarily spent, her shell sinks into the wet sand. She breathes heavily. The turtle knows she must continue further up the beach, away from the wet beating of the high tides, onward to drier sands. She garners another, then another burst of momentum until she finds a suitable site to bury her clutch of eggs. From our dim vantage point, Catherine and I watch the mother turtle shovel out a nest with her back legs. On blind instinct, the tortuga throws sand out to the sides until the hole is large enough for her frame. She then angles her body into the hole so to deposit her eggs. In constipated spurts, her eggs, the size of ping-pong balls, drip from her body. She is focused, yet in a trance. We know that it is this trance quality that allows the pescadores, the egg collectors, the opportunity to slip the soft shell bounty into their bags right behind the unsuspecting mother. Now I understand that the flash-lighted pescadores need not hurry. They can scoop these eggs with their bare hands right into their cloth bags. Quietly, we tread around the nest, wanting to see more. Her eyes are filled with tears. I remember how earlier the guide had told us that turtles use tears as a protective mechanism to keep their eyes moist. With the stars blinking between patches of cloud cover, I think mother. I think eggs. I think baby turtles. I close my own damp eyes, picturing the luminous hope in each egg, the cracking, the primitive thrust for life. I hear the waves move forward and then subside, the giving and the taking away. I take in a sharp breath, my lungs aching. In my mind's eye, I see her eggs, crushed and emptied by faceless predators. The surf pounds and pounds the ground. The whooshing sound funnels into my ears. The sea breeze tickles my forearm. From the periphery, I sense more turtles riding the waves into the isla. I pull my eyes away from the turtle that I've been watching, my trance broken. Hundreds of dark humps jettison the sands, then rest, then scuttle again. The mother near my feet awakens, her trance over too. Now the tortuga sets about hiding her nest. With her back legs as shovels, she sends sand wildly over her eggs, covering them. Then she moves her flat shell over the mound and rocks back and forth as if tucking her eggs in. We laugh when the mother tosses loose sand on top of her creation as a farewell gesture. It is now past midnight, and the pescadoras have retreated. Thousands of stars peer out between the clouds. More turtles roll out of blue waters, their shells glistening in the dim light. A few meters from us, I see a pair of volunteers kneeling behind a turtle in a trance. Unknowingly, the tortuga has tossed out eggs placed there earlier by another turtle. I watch my compañeros gently pick up the scattered eggs and place them in the newcomer's nest. Then they step aside, allowing the mother to complete her work. Across the beach, flashlights blink off and on like winking stars. Even the moon rejoices, floating at last through the hazy clouds to an open space. The waters ripple, electrified. Catherine and I turn off our flashlights as another mother emerges from the sea. We follow her past the tide line where she builds her nest, her eggs, shimmering moons. For Words on a Wire, this is Carolyn Musam Ayoub.
And that wraps it up for this edition of Words on a Wire. Don't forget, the next book you read could save your life.
Kentucky!